From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the weeks leading up to World War I. It's the story of a great composer. See if you can figure out who I'm talking about. This young man had been making a living by playing piano and violin in dance bands, but it became clear that everybody was going to have to go into the service, so he decided he would go in as a musician for the U.S. Navy. He taught himself to play saxophone and other instruments that were just lying around. Then he went to Harvard, graduated summa cum laude in 1924. He went to Paris on a fellowship. After composing his first published score, he returned to teach at Harvard, but he was only getting started with his compositional career. 1936, the Columbia Broadcasting System commissioned six composers to create works for CBS radio broadcasts, and that's when he wrote his Symphony No. 1. He would conduct its premiere with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. His second symphony was premiered by the National Symphony Orchestra 6 years later. His third symphony won a Pulitzer Prize. This composer, of course, was the great American Walter Piston. Who? Yeah, I know. That's kind of what everybody's saying. That's the point here. Even fans of so-called classical music are barely aware of the United States history and the genre. Maybe you know a few names, but you rarely hear American music performed. And according to American composer Alan Fletcher, the works of American composers Piston, Harris, Schumann, Menon, and Elliot Carter were performed just 20 times total by U.S. orchestras in the past 5 years. That's nationwide over a five-year span. And that just means that almost no one is performing the works of some of the great American composers and creators. So Alan Fletcher is working to change that with the Aspen Music Festival, and so is Ward Stair with the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. This hour, we have an exploration of American music, and Ward Stair with the RPO is with us right here in studio. Everybody knows that Piston story, right? That's up there with Tchaikovsky and Mozart.
Oh, yeah. Standard nighttime story for kids, yeah. You know, in the United States. Absolutely.
Thank you for being here. And I can't wait to talk American music with you. I know this is a source of passion for you, and you guys have a lot coming up. So thank you for being here, Ward.
Thank you for having us.
And a brief interlude from my colleague, Elisa Orlando. Hello again.
Hello. Thank you for letting me break in on the conversation before it even begins. But I do want to thank you, Ward, for being here. And thank you, Evan, for providing this kind of conversation. You know, we talk a lot during these fundraising campaigns, which is why I'm here. This is our fall membership campaign. We're asking people to make a pledge by calling us at 454-6300 or making a pledge online, of course, at WXXI.org. During these membership campaigns, we talk a lot about our coverage of news, how our process of engagement helps change policy or helps make policy, helps push debates forward, community conversations. But I also feel like it helps us understand the way we relate to people around us and the way we relate to our own communities, the arts and cultural life of our community. We hope that public radio does that for you. We hope that public media does that for you. And if it does, as you listen to this conversation this afternoon, we hope for sure that you will make a pledge of support at WXXI.org. Think about the ways in which public media is in your life, and then go ahead, put a dollar value on that, and make a pledge at WXXI.org or by calling us at 454-6300. And I look forward to hearing the conversation.
Thank you, Elisa Orlando.
Thank you.
All right, 454-6300. And in a minute, I'll give you the number to call the show, but I don't want to confuse you with too many numbers at once here. So let me go ahead and reintroduce our guests. You just heard Ward Stair, and we also have Alan Fletcher with us. He's the president and CEO of the Aspen Music Festival and School. He's a music administrator and a composer himself. Alan, it's great to have you. Thank you for taking the time.
Terrific. Great to be here.
Well, Ward, I want to start with you. Why did you want to make sure we had Alan Fletcher with us here? I mean, I've been reading his work and the way he's written about so passionately about American music. I know you feel the same. Why did you want Alan with us here?
Well, Alan is, he's such a brilliant composer and musician, and he's got such a great depth of knowledge, particularly about American music and all music, really. And we're featuring Alan's music on our first concert in the American Music Festival, so I thought it would be a perfect way to have a conversation about it.
The American Music Festival is coming up, and tell people some of the details. And we're going to be working through some of the different works, and you're going to hear some pieces this hour. But broadly speaking, what's coming up, Ward?
Well, we have three separate programs over 3 weekends. The first is at Hochstein, so it's slightly smaller in scale, but we have a huge variety on that program. That's where we're going to perform Alan's work, as well as music of David Diamond, George Gershwin, Aaron Copland, and Christopher Rouse. Two of the composers actually have a Rochester connection in Christopher Rouse and David Diamond. And then we move into Kodak Hall, and we're going to perform more great American music by John Adams, Leonard Bernstein, John Williams, Jennifer Higdon, and we'll do one more piece by Aaron Copland, the sort of the American Symphony, Copland's Third, which I'm really much, really, really looking forward to. It's going to be fantastic.
Alan, I opened the hour right at 1 p.m. sharp with a little rumination on the fact that just this morning, a lot of people have been sharing this 90-second video from Canada. It's our Canadian friend saying, hey, America's great, here's why. This PR firm in Toronto said the American political election has been so negative that we've got to make America feel good again. So they got average Canadians to tell America, hey, you're already great, don't get down about yourself, here's why. And at one point in that video, one of the Canadian gentlemen mentioned great American music. And he says jazz? And he talked about a few different styles, but not compositional music. And I'm going, wait, where are we going with the compositional music? Alan, why is it that so many Americans don't really know our own history when it comes to orchestral music?
Yeah, I think we've had a hesitation in front of the great traditions and achievements of Europe. And so people are more likely to look there. My grandfather was Canadian, so I'm happy to hear that they're standing up for us. But I also will just mention that I, of course, knew David Diamond very well. And he was a professor when I was a student. And Chris Rouse has been at Aspen as a mainstay of what we do with new music for many, many years. So I'm thrilled to be on the program that way. But going back to your question, I think that's the main thing. I think it's uncertainty among Americans about our own culture. But when you think of the achievements of film music, for instance, which Ford is including in this series in an important way, film music is one of the most often heard ways that the classical music tradition is experienced around the world. And it centers, I wouldn't say only on American composers, because so many like Max Steiner and Bernard Herrmann came to America, but still it's an American achievement.
I consider this sort of in the same way that I think of James Beard's 1970 book. Now, James Beard wrote about food, and he wanted to write a book called American Cookery in 1970, and he worked on it for 6 years. And he decided we were such a melting pot that you can't just land on one style of American food. He even included Sloppy Joes in there. And some of the other critics in the food world said, come on, man, Sloppy Joes. I mean, you got to raise the bar somewhat here. But James Beard said, we are a melting pot. You know, there you can think of Mexican food, you can think of French food, Italian food, and you sort of know what you're thinking about. But if you said American food, it is more of a melting pot, and there isn't sort of a singular style. And I wonder, Alan, if that has challenged us when it comes to American music, because we have incorporated so much of different greats around the world, different styles. Does that make it more of a challenge for us to land on a single idea of what American music is?
Yeah, I think that's very fair. It's like the people who, for your generations, tried to write the great American novel, and people like David Diamond were in a quest to write the great American symphony. And I think the final answer is there is not going to be a singular style that that achieves that. There's going to be a multiplicity of them. And so one thing, by the way, just to throw in about Chris Rouse, is he is deeply influenced by rock music. And although no one is more classical than Chris, you get this tremendous energy, also with a very American feel to it, from his love for that genre.
By the way, Alan, before I kick it back to Ward, we've had debates on this program about the term classical music in general. I know Alex Ross and others have debated it. So is it okay if I use orchestral music, compositional music, classical? What do you want me to use, Alan?
No, what might be useful is concert music, and then that will include a lot of film music. That will include a lot of jazz, Duke Ellington, a lot of Wynton Marsalis. So music that excels or that benefits from being concentrated on in what I might call a concert hall format.
Okay, well, Ward, what about this question on American music? And we might have just had Alan Flicker. We'll make sure we've got the connection there. Ward, what about this idea of sort of the melting pot that is American music? Does that make it a challenge to put together a program for the RPO? Or is that exciting because you get to touch on different genres and styles?
Well, it's both. It was a challenge for me to select the music for these 3 weekends of concerts because there's just so much out there. But, you know, I think that the fact that we're a melting pot is really an advantage. I think it's what makes American music so special. You know, when we were talking about this plan for the American Music Festival, one of the reasons that I wanted to do it, and there are many, is that it takes a very special kind of orchestra to be able to play American music at a high level because so much goes into it. And the RPO is a great American orchestra, and they can play so many different styles of music at absolutely the top level, which is critical. But, you know, going back to what Alan said, which I think is absolutely true, we sort of have always been in the shadow of the great European masters. And you have to remember that just like our country, you know, the American classical music is much younger. And so, you know, when it started, it really didn't start to find its own identity until midway through the 19th century, because everyone who came over from Europe to settle here brought with them classical music from Europe. So it took a little while for it to evolve. But then once it did, it's fascinating because so many different influences came in. I mean, you had influences from Cuba, you know, Mexico, Latin American. You had Native American influences, African American influences, French influences down in Louisiana. You know, all these different things coming together. And you also had a lot of people, you know, out on the plains, sort of on their own, who had to make music for themselves. Because remember, there wasn't radio or CDs or iPods or anything like that. So if you wanted to have music in your life, which of course we all do, someone had to perform it, someone had to sing it. So then the folk songs and the folk music sort of emerged. And also church music, believe it or not, was a very important thing early in our history. So the hymn tradition, the sort of choral tradition is a very American thing, I think. And when you look at all of that, it's a lot to chew on, you know, when you first talk about it, how it came together. And then it turned into Tin Pan Alley, and it turned into jazz, it turned into blues, it turned into rock and roll. And so I think when you look at our classical music, too, you can easily see the influence of rhythm, for example. I mean, rhythm is a big part of, I think, American classical music. And Chris Rouse is a great example. As Alan mentioned, he's very influenced by that. And he's kind of known for writing really intricate, really powerful percussion passages in his works. So, I mean, I think that for an audience member coming to see an American music festival, it's really a feast because you get to hear so many different styles and so many different ways that the orchestra can express itself, and it's fascinating.
I wonder if this becomes a bit of a spiral, though, away from programming American music. And here's why. We've talked to Ward, especially when you rolled out your the upcoming season. We had a chance to talk about how you made some of those choices and how diverse and interesting those choices were. But you know, you've got this panoply of possibility, and you know. So as Alan has written, and Alan, I mentioned off the top of the program, your research, as you mentioned in one of the articles you wrote, in the last 5 years in this country, the works of Piston, Harris, Schumann, Menon, and Elliot Carter were performed 20 times total in 5 years. It means it's just not happening. And Ward, is that not happening because you know when you're making a decision, if you put Walter Piston on your programming, most Americans, most of your audience haven't heard of it. They may not come to it, so you're less likely to put it there. And then more time passes, and then Piston just doesn't get performed. I mean, is there a pressure on you to program the hits, for example, and does that hurt the possibility that we're going to hear American composition?
Well, unfortunately, that's a very astute observation. It is a factor because, of course, you know, we need to fill the halls. We need to give our public what they are asking for. But I think a lot of people, the trick that I find is to program in an intelligent way so that you have something that, you know, will attract an audience, but you also throw in something new, something different.
I do that all the time, and I walk out of there going, oh, you know what I did not expect? You know, everybody's walking out there going, well, the ninth was great, but wow.
Yeah, and I'm glad. Thank you for saying that. I mean, our opening week is a great example. We did Beethoven 7, and, you know, everybody knows that. But I threw in, because we're doing the American Music Festival, Ron Nelson's Savannah River Holiday to open the program. And nobody knew it. And I got more comments after that concert on the Nelson, believe it or not, because people were surprised at how much they liked it. And that's my goal. And that's how I think you develop a sense of trust with your audience. audience. So as a music director, it's partly my responsibility to, you know, get the audience, get the public in Rochester to trust me when I make decisions like this, so that then they'll come maybe for a program, you know, that has that's not just a 5-minute you know, unknown piece. It's a larger work, and that takes a little bit of time, but it's achievable. It's just you know, it takes a little more work.
We made empanadas last night. My 4-year-old goes, is there squash in there? And I went, you're going to love it. Just eat it. And he eats it and goes, it's actually really good.
Yeah, see?
And there's no reason that American composition has to be the squash in the empanada, because
absolutely,
it turns out we actually love it. We just don't know it.
Absolutely.
Alan Fletcher, you've been addressing some of these issues yourself as a composer and also someone who programs and tries to create this public anticipation for American music. How do you view a sort of a solution to this conundrum?
Well, I like what Ward says, obviously, and I love his programming also, obviously. You know, here's a Chris Rouse story that we had in Aspen. We were doing a piece of his called Gorgon, and it is a very terrifying, crazy, loud piece, and, you know, it's about the Gorgon. So I decided to come up on stage and say something like this: if your idea of classical music is Swan Lake, that's great. I love Swan Lake myself. But you're going to be disappointed in this if that's what you only want to hear. But if you think a story about something riveting, exciting, terrifying, even like death-defying, that it's so crazy, if you're willing to have that experience, then you might like this piece. And I had nice ladies wearing Chanel suits come up to me at the intermission to say, you know, it was all of those things that you said. And they were happy because they just were able to change their expectation for a second and think, I thought I knew what I wanted to hear in a concert hall, but it turns out I could listen to something a little different. So I think education is a big part of it, and reaching out to the audience. You never want the audience to think, they think I ought to like this. You think, they are offering this to me because they love it.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said. Well, rpo.org, if you want tickets to what's coming up here with their first ever American Music Festival at the RPO, it's essentially the next 3 weekends, but you can get all the details at rpo.org. So the schedule, the tickets, and let's listen to a little bit of music here. Now, I always warn the audience that when we are talking about concert music, that there is a real injustice to the music to listen to 40 seconds at a time, a minute and a half at a time, because, number one, these pieces are a lot longer than that. Number two, the sound quality is never as good as seeing it live. But having said that, with that disclaimer, we've got a list here. And Ward, where do you start? What should we listen to a little of first here? Because a lot of this is the kind of stuff we're going to be hearing at the upcoming American Music Festival.
Well, we have, I would say we should kick it off with a little bit of Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man.
Okay, you ready for that, Kat? Let's listen. As we listen here to Fanfare the Common Man here, this is one that's going to be more well-known to the audience. Why did you want this in the lineup?
Well, it's Fanfare for the Common Man is what most people, you know, they think it's just the Fanfare for the Common Man, but actually Copland used it in his Third Symphony. He wrote the fanfare, I think, 3-4 years earlier as part of a campaign where they were getting composers to write inspirational music for the war effort. And then the war ended, and Copland was working on his Third Symphony. And he got a lot of encouragement from his colleagues and friends, including David Diamond, by the way, and said, you have to include the fanfare in the symphony. You must, you must, you must. And so he did. And it's a little bit different when it emerges in the symphony. It's not quite the same, but it's so rousing. It's so impactful. And I think it's a perfect example of... of Copeland's, you know, he's called a populist a lot of the time. And I think that's a really interesting way to describe him, because although he did, you know, have a foray into, you know, very thorny serial music and other sort of genres, at the end of the day, I think Copeland's biggest aim was to really have a direct communication with his audience. And he was somehow able to capture the spirit of America, you know, the sort of purity and beauty of the landscape, the frontier energy, the hymn quality that I talk about. A lot of his music is very simple in its harmonic structure, and it's beautiful in its simplicity, and it's able to reach the audience on a very direct, immediate level, and I think that it's just so powerful. And his Third Symphony was a landmark for him, and for, I think, for all American music, really. I hope Alan would agree with me. It's a very beautiful piece, and so, you know, I thought it was essential really to include in our festival.
Alan, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a fantastic piece, and I do agree with all of that. But Copeland is a very complex composer as well, and his music goes into all different realms of experience. And so if you want to start with, you know, Appalachian Spring and Fanfare for the Common Man, that is perfect, because those are gorgeous pieces. But don't stop with them. Go into some of the other works too.
Well, sure. And let me also just say, everybody takes music, sort of receives it a little differently, but it seems like there is a real unimpeachable sincerity to what we just heard with the fanfare. Mm-hmm. Whereas other pieces that were either commissioned or encouraged to support war efforts, maybe European war efforts, sometimes they're more ambiguous in terms of their tone. You could do a whole, probably an evening or a programming series on war concert music. There's a rich history there. But does that not seem so sincere to you, the fanfare?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I used to be a trombone player, so I performed it as a brass player times. It always, you know, got me when I would perform it every time I conducted. It's such a powerful piece. It really is.
All right.
Your idea about pieces commissioned during wartime. That would be a great set of programs.
Oh yeah.
I'm hired. This is great. If we don't raise enough money in our pledge drive this week, and they've got to cut me out of WXXI, I'm going to come work with you at the RPO.
All right.
That sound pretty good. We're talking to Ward Stair from the RPO and Alan Fletcher, who is a composer and the CEO of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and we're talking about American music. And we've been focusing on the upcoming American Music Festival that Ward and the RPO is putting on. You've got a chance to hear some classic American, I say classic, I mean really, really wonderful stuff, but the kind of thing, when you hear the fanfare, you may recognize it. There's going to be music that you may not recognize immediately, but this is the kind of music that we should include in the pantheon of great American music. What else is on the list, Ward? What do you want to hit next here?
Should we listen to something else?
Yeah, well, why not?
Yeah, well, let's do it. Let's see, what do we have? While we're talking about... Well, we were just talking about David Diamond, so why don't we hear a little bit of his rounds? This is David Diamond from Rochester.
Okay. I'll just let Ward kind of weigh in as we heard David Diamond there. Again, Rochester's mm-hmm. David Diamond. Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about what we're hearing here.
Well, this is a piece that he wrote actually around the same time as Copeland was writing the Fanfare and the Third Symphony in the mid-40s. It's only for string orchestra, so it shows off that part of the group without the winds and brass. And it's just, you know, it's not as complex as some of the pieces that he wrote later. He wrote a lot of really beautiful symphonies. He wrote some very ethereal, sort of very colorful music. You know, he wrote a piece by inspired by Paul Klee and all sorts of other great music. But this was something that was an immediate hit for him right from the start, and sort of was throughout his entire career. And it's a great piece for the strings. And I always like to feature a section of the orchestra if possible. So that plus the Rochester connection, I thought, you know, again, I had to include it in the festival.
Alan, thoughts on David Diamond?
Well, he was sort of one of my teachers. I knew him when I was a student, very complex, very brilliant man, but he was extremely sincere. I think that's a good word for it. And I think you hear that in Rounds, which is one of his most popular pieces, is that it's extremely genuine in putting something out there that reaches to an audience. And I could say a whole lot of things about David Diamond because I had a very complex relationship with him, but that he was a fabulous composer, I would certainly start with that.
Underappreciated, I think.
Yeah.
For sure.
When can you hear David Diamond with RPO?
This Sunday. On the same program as Alan's piece. And actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about that, too, because one thing that's always great, you know, for all of us all over the world, but I think especially with American music, is collaboration. And this piece that we're performing of Alan's was actually a co-commission. I'll let Alan tell you more about that. But I'm excited about it because there's a film that goes with it. And I've done a lot of work with film in the past, and you're always sort of bound by the time clock, and it's sort of, you know, you can't really make music as freely as you'd like to, but this is a new invention or a new, you know, way of doing it so that I don't have to worry about that. I can just make the music, perform Alan's piece, and only care about, you know, making phrases and doing it, you know, in the moment. And then the film's going to follow me, and it's really cool, and the inspiration for it is fascinating. When Alan told me about this piece, I was really hooked. It's about this really intriguing story, and I'll let Alan tell you more about it now because it's really, really amazing.
Go ahead, Alan.
Okay, so short version, I wanted to write a piece about Italy. I spend a lot of time in Italy, and wanted to write a piece also about storytelling. I think so much great art is about telling a story, whether it's in picture, by film, or in music, or, of course, in words. And so I worked with a novel by an Italian novelist, Italo Calvino, called If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, and wanted to make a piece that just did some of the same things the novel does. It's not very direct, but then I worked with this great film artist, Bill Morrison, who's worked with Philip Glass and Terry Reich and David Lang and Julia Wolf and a whole lot of great composers. And as Ward says, what he does is he makes the video to the music. And so if you're John Williams writing for Star Wars, you're writing the music to fit the film, or the music is going to be cut to the film. But in Bill Morrison's case, it goes exactly the other direction. So it's all about telling stories and being very surprised by the stories you're telling.
Anyone want to add there, Ward?
No, it's... There's a connective tissue, which is the opening material, which sort of ties everything together. But it's you have to read the book, and I have to admit I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read parts of it, and it's pretty out there at times. But it's also it's fascinating because of the way he sets up. You know, a lot of it's in the second person, and you know he's talking to the reader, you know, as though you know. Through their experience of reading, and it's amazing. So what I love about Alan's music is he takes you to all these different places in the course of this piece, but then it's all connected at the end, and you feel like you've been on a really, really amazing journey. I think, you know, when you finish, kind of like the book, you don't really have a lot of answers, but it's a fascinating journey, and I love it.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back with Ward Stair and Alan Fletcher, and we're talking about the American Music Festival, the RPO, has it offering to you. 3 weekends coming up here, rpo.org for the full schedule, and we'll come right back and keep going down the list of great American music, especially the kind of American music that you may not be familiar with. That's coming up. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. First hour, Republican Gatestown Supervisor Mark Essini joins us. He's running for Congress, challenging longtime incumbent Louise Slaughter. We have invited both candidates. This is our sit-down interview with Mark Essini. Then, in the second hour, we're talking about the rise of third parties. Or is there a rise of third parties? Can there be a rise of third parties in this country? Join us Thursday. Well, welcome back here. Wow, that was a fast break. You know what? That's another thing that your pledge dollars support. I'm going to stress this. I barely made it back to the chair. It is really just about the shortest break in any radio programming anywhere you go because we want it to be 51, 52 minutes an hour. Nobody else is doing that. And by the way, it's not 52 minutes an hour and 8 minutes of underwriting. There's NPR news and so much that goes into it. And so my colleague Elisa Orlando is back here. We can sustain that because of our members. We always say member-supported public radio, and this is the chance because we need that right now.
That's true. And also, you're not going to hear commercials, advertisements. We call it underwriting. There are sponsorship messages, but it is commercial-free. And it's great to point out at this time of year, when you're hearing a lot of political advertising in commercial media, that you aren't hearing it here. We cannot and will not take it here in public media, which is why we need your dollars. You make everything possible that happens here. And as I listen to the program today, Evan, I think about all the ways that a program like this and the reporting that we do on NPR helps us kind of understand the problems of contemporary life and the possibilities, the prospects of contemporary life. We dig deep. We do enterprise, long, in-depth news reporting that's made possible by our members. So it's made possible by your friends and neighbors, people that you agree with, people that you disagree with. We all come together in support of public radio when we make a pledge. You make a pledge by going online at WXXI.org or by calling us at 454-6300. We have volunteers here even now to answer your call. So please know that you make it possible. If you're enjoying Evan's program, we ask for a pledge of support. And Evan, thanks for all you do. And Ward, thanks for being here today.
All right. Thank you, Elisa Orlando. 454-6300. Let's continue with our discussion of the RPO's American Music Festival. Is this going to be an annual or at least a semi-annual thing, Ward? How do you feel about it?
You know, a lot of people have been asking me that. I would be thrilled if we could do it every year. We'll have to see because, you know, we only have a limited number of spaces to program in a given season. But American music is very important to me. And, you know, since I've been here, I've been doing a lot of it and I plan to continue. So you'll absolutely continue to hear great American music.
And on that list here, I'm just going to bring up the Dr. Atomic Symphony. Can we hit that one next year?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should I set it up a little bit?
Yeah,
why don't you tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear this time?
Well, this is a piece that comes from an opera of the same name, Dr. Atomic, which is by John Adams. And as the title suggests, it deals with the Manhattan Project and Oppenheimer and all the tension and all the uncertainty and really the crazy time that was. I mean, there are scenes in the opera, you know, right before they set off the first test. And, you know, there were people at the time who were scared that maybe the entire atmosphere would ignite. I mean, this was just, you know, and not to mention we were in World War II, and it was just a very intense period for everyone. And John Adams' music captures this so brilliantly, I think. And the opera, of course, is much longer than the symphony, which he's sort of boiled it down, but he's got some of the best music in the symphony. And I love it. I actually knew this piece when it was first done. I saw it at Lyric Opera Chicago, and it's got some really intense, terrifying moments. It's got some very beautiful moments. There's a big aria where Oppenheimer sings. He quotes John Donne and "Batter My Heart" in the opera, and it's played by the trumpet in the symphony, and it's quite touching. And I think it's a very powerful work and something that's never been done in Rochester.
All right, let's listen a little bit here. It's remarkably easy to understand the feeling and the emotion there. I mean, that's
right.
music conveying kind of a moment, I guess.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's so much that goes into it. Actually, in the symphony, there's a part which in the opera is sung by, you know, a military general who's barking orders left and right and all the confusion and, you know, the laboratory and the frenzy of activity. And the first trombone player actually stands up in the middle of the orchestra and starts playing these lines. It's very, very intense. And the orchestra is just, you know, has all these huge climaxes. And it's just so packed with energy. It's an amazing piece.
Alan, you want to weigh in on that one?
Yeah, I think that Dr. Atomic, it's a fantastic score, and that's an example of where if you can give it, you know, a little longer, you'll really get a lot out of it. So you get the sort of simple emotion of that, but it really packs a punch when you give it a longer chance.
Oh, absolutely. And we're going to set it up, by the way, in that concert with Charles Ives' Unanswered Question, which is a very interesting piece. And so that program is actually sort of in two parts. The first half is a little bit lighter, a little bit more fun. We have Gershwin's I Got Rhythm Variations. We have a piece that John Williams wrote for Leonard Bernstein called For New York, which was in honor of Leonard Bernstein's 70th birthday. So it quotes, you know, some of Lenny's best stuff, and it's by John Williams. So it's, you know, he wrote more than Star Wars, which people need to remember. And then we have Leonard Bernstein's On the Waterfront, which is the only film score that he ever did. So there's a nice film connection there. And, you know, that's got some serious moments, but it's a little bit lighter on the first half. Then we open the second half with the Ives, which is a fascinating piece. And Charles Ives, I just want to say, is one of my favorite American composers. He was really a pioneer. He was writing music, you know, over 100 years ago, and a lot of it didn't really emerge or gain any popularity or notoriety until much, much later. But he was experimenting. I mean, he wrote symphonies where... and I've conducted one of them where, you know, there have to be two conductors on stage at once and there are multiple ensembles and it's all sorts of craziness. But it's so inventive and so ingenious and forward-looking. And the Unanswered Question is interesting because he has three basic parts to it. There's a string motive, which is very calm and very plain. I think he says it's supposed to be like the Druids who, you know nothing, see nothing, just this very neutral kind of atmospheric quality about it. And then the question is posed by the trumpet. And the trumpet line is not in any key, which if you consider, you know, the time, you know, 100 years ago, roughly, when he was writing this, that was pretty out there for him to do that. And it's just this meandering, very sort of vague question. And then the answer comes in a woodwind ensemble, and the answer gets more and more complex. He actually, Ives calls it the fighting answer. And then it's almost as though the question keeps being posed over and over again. And then eventually the answer sort of goes away. It's like it fights for the answer, doesn't really come up with anything. And then we have one last statement of the question, and that's how the piece ends. And from there, we'll dive into the Dr. Atomic Symphony, which I think will be very powerful because Oppenheimer himself was asking a lot of questions, which one could argue today still remain unanswered about the whole atomic era, which was ushered in.
This is why you need to not only see the RPO, but when Ward is doing some of the talkback stuff, which I would like you to do as much as you can, I always appreciate that. I could listen to Ward sort of just riff on these pieces. So, and I love that you've given the audience a chance to hear that on some occasion. I want to get a couple of your comments in that have come in. First of all, John says, "Don't be the squash in the empanada" is my new favorite euphemism. Well, there you go. Thank you, John. That's great. My colleague from down the hall, and I love that my colleague Mona Segatola-Salami is spamming my Twitter feed with comments and questions. Our colleagues at Classical 91.5 are the best, and they really should be here. I mean, it's just almost a crime that Ward and Alan have to put up with me. But Mona has a lot of great questions, not the least of which is this, and I'll ask both of you this. She says, I might have missed it, but what about how orchestras really used to play lots of new American music in the early 20th century? A lot of this is familiar from movies, TV, and other culture, even more so than some European classics, but it got sort of more attention in the early 20th century. Alan, what would you say to that?
That is true, absolutely. And so people like David Diamond and William Schumann and Walter Piston, for that matter, were getting lots of performances by major orchestras through the mid-century. And then things changed. I don't think in a short format I can say anything too smart about it, but I can say what the answer is, and that's going to be more homegrown American conductors like Ward. Who really will take the part of this music because it's part of their own background. And so I think the more American-based and American-trained conductors we have as music directors, the better.
But, Alan, does that make it... how do I want to... You know, you're composing music, and it's 2016, and American composers, for whatever reason, are not getting performed. And you don't want to feel like the tree that falls in the forest. And there's got to be a way to change that. But is that frustrating for you as a composer, knowing that there's a little bit of a limited audience? And I'm not going down this road of is classical dying. It's not. We're not doing that. But, you know, Is there a frustration as an American composer in 2016, knowing that even the great American composers don't really get performed very often?
No, I wouldn't say frustrating, because, as you say, you write music because you just have to write music. You don't write it because it's going to be a huge commercial success for you. And just to flip the question, Charles Ives is one of the most popular American composers in Europe. So if you ask really smart classical music lovers in Europe who are the really important American composers in the 20th century, they will instantly say Ives. And very often John Cage as well. So you never know what's going to take and when it's going to take.
Ward?
That's true. Well, as Alan said, this is a very complex topic, but to try to answer it as succinctly as I can, I would say that it really goes back to education. And that's this is something that I'm very passionate about, and I know Alan is too. I think the one thing that has changed the most since, you know, that period Mona referred to where we were getting more performances of new works is education. And you know, I think when you have a public who, I'm not saying that they were all, you know, professional musicians back then, but they had some basic knowledge of it. So I think it was a little bit more intriguing to go hear a brand new piece. Whereas nowadays, unfortunately, we have so many people in our society who have little or no music education or really exposure other than what they may hear on TV or, you know, pop culture. And it creates more distance between what we do and the public, which didn't always exist. I mean, there was a time when everybody had at least a basic knowledge or exposure to it, you know, from their public school days even. And that's sort of starting to go away. And I think it's alarming. And I think it's crucial that we all work together to ensure that we reverse that trend. And I think if that happens, then we can, you know, we'll start to see a little bit more risk-taking on the part of the public in terms of hearing new music.
Alan?
Yeah, if I can jump on that, I'd say absolutely yes. And so I think if you're a kid in the U.S., in at least near any major urban area, who has a tremendous musical talent, things are going to be okay for you. People are going to find you. There's going to be resources for you. That's not the problem. The problem is that every kid should have the experience of what it is to sing or to play a band instrument or to play a drum set or to do something that's making their own music. It's not that they should be musicians. All the better if they go off to be engineers and business people and doctors and lawyers and teachers and will work on the line, whatever they're doing. But they have that experience of what making music, of how thrilling that is. And I think then when you're an adult, that gives you a much better connection to how exciting something like the Rochester Philharmonic is.
Anne writes to the program and says, hi, Evan, just wanted to shout out that the Hochstein Youth Orchestra is playing Copland's Quiet City on their fall concert. Oh. That's on Sunday, November 13th at 7. She says tickets are only $5, so it might be another way to let children get exposed to American classical music by seeing other kids play it.
Absolutely.
So, and that's very cool, and thank you for bringing that to our attention. Alyssa writes to the program and just says, Evan, doesn't seem that classical music has a great history of having women at the helm. Does American music veer any differently? That's from Alyssa.
Well, that's at the helm. Are we talking about conductors or composers or both?
She did not say.
We're not sure.
I can only read the email. But let's get into to composing. I mean, that's a good question.
Well, it is true that there are fewer women in both those fields, you know, conducting and composing. And I'm not. I think Alan could probably give a better answer if there is one to why. But there are a lot of really great female composers and American composers. In fact, one of them is featured in our American Music Festival, and that's Jennifer Higdon. We're doing her percussion concerto, which is a wonderful piece. And the soloist for whom it was written, Colin Curry, will be with us in Rochester. So I'm very excited about that. But Alan, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, here I'll get political since we're on this particular day with the debate this evening.
yeah.
I do think that of composing and conducting, there has been a structural bias against women in the way we teach those things. And it's not universal, and there are great exceptions, but overall, it has been easier in the past couple of generations for a young woman to say, I want to play the horn. And maybe 100 years ago, people would say, that's insane. But by 40 years ago, people would say, well, of course, sure, you want to play the horn.
Right.
But when that same young woman says, and I want to conduct, there were plenty of people in the business who would say, no, no, you don't want to do that. So those of us who are in education, I think, still are overcoming that. As I say, I'm sorry I'm making a political statement about affirmative action, but I think there has been a prejudicial reason why women have not come to the top as often. But Jennifer Higdon's a perfect example. Now they are.
Right.
And Jennifer is one of the greatest living composers. And we had, for 2 weeks, Kaya Sarriaho with us in Essen last summer, and she is absolutely one of the greatest living composers. And I think when we can dismantle some of those barriers, you'll see a very different world.
Okay. Ward, why don't you tell us a little bit about what we're listening to right now?
Well, this is the Jennifer's percussion concerto, which there's a huge array of instruments, as you know, its percussion family is just enormous. There's a lot of marimba in it, however, which is Colin's favorite instrument. Apparently, Jennifer worked closely with Colin when she was writing the piece. And one thing I like about it, also, we won't hear it probably in this excerpt, but the percussion section in the orchestra is also very prominent throughout. So it's a workout for our percussionists and, of course, for the soloist. And for anyone who doesn't understand what a percussion concerto is, it's a visual feast as well as an oral one. I mean, you hear so many different sounds, and you get to see the choreography actually that the percussionist has to go through with the you know, huge number of instruments that he has to play during the piece. It's really fascinating. I think everyone should come see this piece.
Is it here? This is the ignorant side of me coming out big time now, Ward. But is it different conducting a percussion concerto in any way? I mean, is it more of a challenge in any way?
Well, sometimes it can be a challenge of space because you have to fit all those instruments around you up on the podium. But I don't think it's more or less challenging than any other concerto, but it's not an experience that you get as often. So I'm really looking forward to it.
And you said that Higdon is one of the great, you and Alan both said, one of the great composers. Why? Why is she considered so great?
Well, I think that, any composer, for me, who I would say, is just really a great composer, is one who finds his or her own voice first and foremost. And so, when you listen to someone's music, you want to be able to say, ooh, there's something new there. There's something unique about that style or that voice or that, the way he or she used harmony or orchestral texture. And Jennifer has definitely crafted her own sound. I mean, you listen to any of her pieces and it's not hard to guess that, oh, that sounds like a Jennifer Higdon piece. But she also, I love the energy that she puts into all of her music. She's got a great sense of lyricism and color as well. And I think it's so well balanced. And it's very much like Copland in that it communicates in a very direct way to the audience. And it's also, for me, it's great because it's so well written, like Alan's music too, by the way. Alan, I'm about to rehearse your piece for the first time this afternoon, and I love that the parts and the music are all so well written and so well taken care of, and so it's really a pleasure to conduct when you have a composer like that.
Very good. Well, Higdon, Copland, and Barber is on Thursday, November 3rd, as part of the RPO's American Music Festival. We've heard Higdon just now. We heard Copland. Can we hear a little bit of Barber?
Let's do that.
We've got Samuel Barber, and what do we have from Barber that, Kat, you can throw right up underneath us, I think. And Ward, why don't you tell us a little bit about this one?
Well, it's Medea's Meditation and Dance of Vengeance. And if you've been coming for the last couple years to the RPO concerts, you know I'm a huge Barber fan. I've already done a lot of his music. I think he's another composer who has a very unique voice. I love his style. He's a little bit more of a romantic, traditional composer than some, but I like this piece because I think it's really like a great American tone poem. I mean, it's got all the drama and power of a Strauss tone poem, and it's very intense subject matter too. I mean, we're talking about vengeance, betrayal, jealousy, all sorts of really complex emotions. And the piece is really, it's structured, it's a great arc, and it just builds and builds, and it's got quite a climax at the end. So I wanted to include it for sure on the festival because Barber's one of my favorite composers. He's a great American composer, and I thought it went nicely with the Copland and the Higdon.
Thoughts on Barber, Alan?
Yeah, also one of my favorites. And I just thought I'd throw in on the Jennifer Higdon thing.
Sure.
Because finding your voice is key, what Ward said. Also, very important is the craft. And it's one thing to say, I want to reach directly to my audience, which is a great thing to say. That doesn't mean you're going to succeed in writing music that'll last just because you started with that. You need a tremendous skill, and that's where Jennifer is a master. Mm-hmm.
Well, Alan, as we get ready to wrap up our last 2 minutes here, some final thoughts from you on American music in general. This is something that you not only do, you compose, but you have been passionate about, whether you're writing or programming and creating this chance for audiences to experience. And a lot of us who love these genres of music have been missing the American side of it. What's your closing message for our listeners?
Give this a chance. I think you'll like it. I think it's been presented with a lot of passion and a lot of emotion and a lot of knowledge and then the tremendous, tremendous skill of the Rochester Philharmonic and Ward's chair. So I think it's a good bet.
Ward, some final thoughts from you?
Well, thank you for that, Alan. It's very kind. I think that, Rochester has been a very important city for almost 100 years in classical music, American classical music in particular. So, I want us to all be proud of this American Music Festival. I want us to all be proud of our heritage and our identity as American classical musicians. And I want us to, I want everyone to experience our orchestra in a different way during these three programs, because the variety, the range, and the virtuosity that will be on display over these next 3 weekends is really going to be tremendous. So I hope we can really connect with our audience, and I hope everyone will really enjoy it.
RPO.org. Alan Fletcher, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been our great pleasure.
Great. It's been a pleasure.
And Ward Stair is the music director for the RPO. Always great to see you, and we'll see you over the next few weekends with the American Music Festival. Thank you, Ward.
Sounds good. Thank you.
I just want to mention, we're in the middle of Pledge. And you know what's exciting for me? A chance, as Elisa Orlando said earlier, we talk a lot of politics, especially with the state of the campaign right now. But we try to break it up a little bit. And we had a chance to talk music in this program in a way that is, I think, cutting edge. Look at what we've done in the last year alone. Well, just yesterday, we talked Bob Dylan and the Nobel Prize. Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People were in with their remarkable music that could easily go national. We did a whole hour on Beyoncé's new album. We've talked Kaki King, who's maybe the greatest guitar player in the world today. She plays one guitar, and it sounds like she's playing three at the same time. We feature local artists. We feature the RPO. We talk international music, American music. We try to do all of that here. It's part of our mission to bring you everything in the sort of the art world and the music world. And I just want to thank you for listening. And our thanks to Kat Schwartz. Great to see you back here, Kat Schwartz, behind the glass. Megan Mack is the outstanding producer of this broadcast. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to hang out with you this afternoon on All Things Considered, making sure you know that we need your pledged dollars. Have a great afternoon, and I'll talk to you on this program tomorrow.